Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first WHO webinar series. My name is Cyrus, and I work for the Patient Safety Program at the World Health Organization and actually manage work out of its Baltimore office that is located at Johns Hopkins University. It gives me great pleasure today to introduce Professor Don Goldman. Professor Goldman is the Senior Vice President for the Institute of Healthcare Improvement that was founded by Don Berwick, who, as you might know, was picked up by President Obama to head the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, a federal agency. In addition, Dr. Goldman is the Professor of Pediatrics at the Harvard Medical School in Boston, and Distinguished Professor of Immunology and Infectious Diseases and Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. Professor Goldman is an eminent clinician and researcher whose interests cut across infectious diseases, health services, and quality improvement research. He has published widely and presented at various national and international meetings in these areas. Professor Goldman is also a core group member of the WHO's Patient Safety Program, an initiative titled Clean Care is Safer Care, whose focus is on hand hygiene as a strategy to prevent the spread of nosocomial infections in healthcare facilities. He has contributed significantly to the development and finalization of WHO's strategy on hand hygiene, including the finalized hand hygiene guidelines in healthcare, which are today being used globally. In research on infection control, Professor Goldman is focusing on measures to improve compliance with hand hygiene and other barrier techniques, as well as on improving antimicrobial use. He is currently the chair of Risk Group 4 of Bacteriology and Mycology Study Group, funded by NIAID, which conducts clinical trials of interventions designed to reduce antimicrobial resistance in ICUs and other high-risk settings. Indeed, it is rare to come across a clinician who is an expert in the fields of quality improvement, infectious diseases, epidemiology, and the broader field of health services research. Professor Goldman, we are indeed fortunate to have you kickstart the first of a series. Thank you so much for agreeing to be here with us today and for sharing your thoughts on the topic of quality improvement science and infection prevention.
Thank you very much. First, I want to apologize for the audience if I sound a little hoarse or occasionally cough as I'm recovering from a viral upper respiratory tract infection, which occurred despite my, I guarantee you, fastidious attention to the use of alcohol-based hand rub. So, nothing is perfect, but I'm sure I would have many more of these infections if I weren't adhering to my own advice. So today, I'm going to ask you to be patient with me because I'm going to give you a fair amount of theoretical background based on the way we work here at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and also based on my experience in health services research. I'll try and keep it interesting by interspersing some examples from the field so you won't think that I'm just a pointy-headed academic. As I go through, I will try and remember to tell you to go to the next slide. So you should be seeing now the slide that gives my titles and the title of this performance today. And if you can go to the next slide, you see I have nothing of any importance that declares a conflict of interest. And the next slide shows the roadmap we'll be talking about. I'm going to be giving you some of my own personal journeys and lessons I've obtained in measurement and in improvement. I'm going to talk about how we at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, that I'll call us IHI from now on, we use the theory and essentials, a little bit about will, ideas, and execution, which are among the more useful terms I've found in this field, a little bit on how to go from R&D to spread and dissemination. I want to discuss with you how much evidence is good enough. I think that's a real issue. I'll give you some quote-unquote rigorous examples from the front line to show that really pretty good work can be done despite all of the problems that we face, as busy as we are. And then finally, we'll talk a fair amount about reliability and bundles, and I'm going to talk through MRSA and some other bundles so that you're sure to understand all of that. So that's a lot to cover. I understand I have about an hour. I'll do my best. If I find that my penchant for storytelling is getting in the way, I'll try and skip some stuff and speed up. So on the next slide, I'm going to tell you a personal journey. My first quality improvement station on the journey, improving emergency department efficiency. I no sooner started my job at the Children's Hospital when the chief of my department said that a board of trustees child had been in the emergency room for 8 hours, and I was to meet with the chief medical officer and the chief nursing officer and the head of the emergency department, anybody else I cared to fix the problem. And so I quickly read about how to run a meeting. There's a very good references you can easily find on how to run a good quality meeting. But basically, it's democratic. Everybody gets to speak. You obey the rules, and you strive above all else for civility and consensus. What did I find? I find that everybody was angry at everybody else. The emergency department was angry at the doctors on the ward because they would come down to the emergency department and delay everything by asking for a lot of tests. The nurses in the emergency department were mad at the nurses on the ward because the beds weren't ready quickly enough. And the people on the wards were equally angry at the emergency department for a variety of other reasons, but the patients were paying the price. So the first thing we did, on the next slide you see, I just asked people to map the process it takes to get a patient from the emergency room to a bed once the decision has been made by a doctor to admit the patient. And I'm not going to go through all this, but you can see it's a very complicated process with lots of loops and rework and awkward communications. And, oh, by the way, it goes on to another page, the next slide, and required 5 footnotes to explain. So I think everybody was surprised by this, and it got them to be a little more collegial because we had to talk to the nurses, the housekeepers, the doctors, everybody involved in the admission process. After a lot of work, we managed to simplify the process down to something that looks like this on the next slide. And you can see that's a lot more streamlined. Now, the point of this example is not to tell you that we fixed all the problems and children arriving in our hospital now sail through the emergency room and smiling parents usher them to their bed. It's still a real problem, but you can see how much unnecessary work and waste we got out of the system. And that's a prime lesson from today's lecture I hope you'll take away. None of you have time to waste. Those of you working in resource-constrained environments have probably less time than anyone to waste. So getting your processes understood and simplified is very important. So on the next slide, next lesson from my personal journey, epidemiology can take you only so far. So I'm an epidemiologist, and I really believe in epidemiology, but epidemiology is not the same as improvement. So on the next slide, this is a little bit complicated, but I'm going to make it simple, I hope. You see here 6 neonatal intensive care units in a region of the United States. And those colored lines represent the cumulative rate or incidence of bloodstream infection, depending on how long the patients have been in the hospital. This is adjusted for the severity of illness of the patient using a very sophisticated model that we developed with some colleagues. This takes out of the equation, really, that some patients are sicker than others in one or other of these units. And I think that if you were unlucky enough to have your baby born needing an intensive care unit, you probably wouldn't want to be in the red unit, the top line there, because that has really about double the rate of infection over time as the other units. And maybe you'd want to be in the lavender one, the line there at the bottom, which has a far lower rate, maybe a quarter of the red place. So the clinicians all screamed bloody murder. They very unhappy about this study, and they said, well, you really have to adjust for certain treatments that we know are risk factors, like parenteral nutrition or ventilators. And I said, well, no, I really don't want to adjust for that, because if you're using those modalities, those therapies, too often, why do I want to obscure that? Why do I want to hide your utilization? But I said, okay, we'll do it anyway, because I'm a nice guy. And on the next slide, you can see, just looking at parenteral nutrition, on day three, the range in use of parenteral nutrition, and mind you, these are units that have the same overall growth of the babies and so forth. Look at the range on day three, and by day 14, the range is phenomenal. Some units are still giving almost every baby nutrition by vein, whereas another one down the bottom is giving it only 20% of the time. So enormous practice variation. But on the next slide, even adjusting for all of that, for the severity of illness, for the therapies, for everything we measure, there's still a vast difference, and the red unit is still the worst. So what does this tell me? It tells me that there are many unmeasured variables that are important in trying to understand what's going on in these units, and that just describing this problem and adjusting for what we know how to adjust for is not the end, that we now need further exploration to understand this variation and to actually improve care so that the experience will be like it is in those bottom two units that have the lowest rates of infection. So just some lessons that I've learned. There's always waste and complexity, and epidemiology can only take you so far. Now, another problem, of course, is clinician distrust. I would imagine many of you are physicians. Physicians are the most virulent in distrusting quality improvement. Those of you who are nurses and hygienists and infection preventionists, whatever you are, I'm sure you have some skepticism. So this is what I've found, that many people associate quality improvement with old-style punitive quality assurance, that we're going to find outliers, and by golly, we're going to punish them. And that's not really what improvement's about. It's about improving everybody's performance. The second point is QI gurus overemphasize the industrial origin of QI, make it into some sort of religion. Came somewhere from the East, and with Deming went to Japan, and the Japanese had a revolution, and we only thought like the Japanese. That doesn't really cut much mustard here in the United States, to use our expression, especially, of course, the people who overemphasized in this first place laugh as Toyota has its recalls. But there is a lot there to learn from, as long as we don't jargonize it and pretend that we each have our own methodology, like Six Sigma or Lean or IHI's model for improvement. There's enormous overlap among these methods, and it's not so much which tool you use, but how you use it. The next point, QI experts focus on non-clinical processes and outcomes too much. Now, I care about waiting times. I really, really do. And I care about what the patients think about me. Honestly, I really, really do. But, you know, speaking to urologists about transurethral resection of the prostate for people with prostatic hypertrophy, and, you know, they care about waiting times, and they care about satisfaction of the patients. That's really important to them, too. They're in a service industry. But what they really care about is, did I get all the prostate out so that I actually solved the problem? Did I get too aggressive? Does the patient now leak urine? Are they impotent? These are important clinical outcomes, and if you can't speak to them, then you're probably not going to engage a lot of clinicians. Next point, teams who do QI by the book have to follow a rigid process, get bogged down in tedious work, and settle for small incremental improvements. That's not the idea here. We're looking for real fundamental change, and it doesn't always work to just get everybody together and go through all the steps of quality improvement. You have to meet them where they are and explain what it is you're trying to do in whatever way works for them. Next slide. QI leaders are not upfront about the fiscal agenda. You know, we tend to say, oh, quality saves money. Well, that's not enough. I mean, quality can actually cost money initially. Just as an example, if as a result of quality improvement, we increase the rate of antiretroviral therapy in South Africa from 20% to 70%, there's a cost to that. Let's be honest, there's a long-term saving in suffering, in economic terms, any way you want to look at it. But you have to at least examine what the cost is and try and decide on the value of what you're doing. Value is basically quality divided by cost, and cost is important. No sense putting it under a rug. Next point, QI programs don't provide clinicians with the data they need to improve. You know, real-time feedback of the data is absolutely important. I remember when the surgeons in the United States threatened to drop out of the CDC programs and do their own surveillance for surgical site infection, because under the existing program, they weren't getting their own infection rates back, and they were sick and tired of it, and they didn't want to wait 6 months for a report from the federal government that only talked about all the surgeons in the hospital. They wanted their own data. Good point. And finally, there is an academic potential to quality improvement, as I hope I'll show later if we have time with some examples. So those of you working in places where promotion counts or recognition counts, there is potential there. So on the next slide, I've often found that quality improvement is easier to teach and easier to implement in countries other than the U.S., in countries where there is limited resource or less, I would say, jaded feelings about such things as quality. And this is the study we did in Colombia at the height of the crisis, where the drug cartels were, in fact, inflicting violence even in the city. I drove around in an armored car. The two neonatal units and maternal units in which we worked were served all the poor people of Bogota. It was a very constrained and difficult circumstance. So did we give them a three-month course in quality improvement? No. On the next slide, we just did very simple real-time teaching. So we said, let's look at the causes of what you're concerned about, which in their case was the high rate of endometritis after cesarean delivery and wound infection after cesarean delivery. And, you know, they began to think about it, and they said, well, it really goes into five buckets: the antibiotic prophylaxis, skin prep, the technique, what the mother brings to the delivery room, and then what you do around the time of delivery. And then within that, if you look on the spines of what I'll call a fishbone diagram, you can see a more detailed view of all the things that go into these five buckets. Now, I could say this is a Ishigawa diagram, and I could talk about Deming and profound knowledge and carry around weighty textbooks, but this is pretty intuitive, frankly, for a bunch of clinical people who sat around a table with a cup of really decent Colombian coffee and figured out what it was they thought might cause these infections. So next slide, they said, well, you know, we've heard that antibiotic prophylaxis is important, but what's the data? So we got out a meta-analysis, and these are all the studies showing that antibiotics really work. These are odds ratios, so any crosshatch that goes below 1.0 is protective, and the vertical lines are the confidence intervals in this statistical analysis. And anybody from the back of the room can see that antibiotics are universally and statistically significantly effective in reducing these infections. There can be no doubt about that at all. Now, sometimes I've found if I'm presenting, I'll make an example up, not to pick on anybody, but in India, and I'm talking to some Indian physicians, and they'll say, well, have these studies been done in India? And in general, the answer is, well, maybe there are a few, but most of these studies are not done in India. And so when I hear that, my first reflex is saying, oh, you know, this is just like everybody wants to prove it in their own country or in their own hospital. I used to be pretty, you know, vigorous about that, being unreasonable. But, you know, now I think contexts are all different, and really at least you have to understand why those people felt that it might not apply to them. And context is everything, and we'll come back to that later to show that understanding the local context will get you a lot farther than just saying the evidence is the evidence. Next slide. So we did a simple priority matrix because you can't do everything at once. This matrix was actually a little more complicated. We had cost and other issues in there. But basically, you see here the five factors the clinicians had identified as probably important in infection. And they gave them a score of 1 to 4 as to their importance, whether or not they and that hospital could actually improve the situation, and then how long it might take. And you can see down the bottom there, they thought that what happens in the delivery process and around the time of birth is very important, but they weren't so sure that they really could deal with it in a very quick fashion. The antenatal factors, they said, well, they're coming in this way, and we'd love to work in the outskirts of Bogota on these nutrition and prenatal screening. That's going to be hard. It's going to take a long time. So they settled on especially antibiotic prophylaxis, which they thought they could lick right away. So what's the first thing you do in the next slide? You look at current performance, and there are two hospitals. And what they found with a simple review of, I don't remember if it was 20 charts, it didn't take a lot of time to do this, that in Hospital A, 70% did get prophylaxis, but only 30% of them got it within the time they're supposed to get it, which is very important in surgical care. And in Hospital B, it was the reverse. Only 32% got the antibiotic, but at least when they did get it, they tended to get it on time. So nobody would look at that and say that's reliable, excellent care. And then we did the old system diagram to try and understand what's going on. Now, you've seen one system diagram. Here's another on the next slide. This is Hospital A, and I'll just run through it. It's not too lengthy, but they plan to perform a cesarean delivery. And the next question is, are we going to prescribe prophylaxis? And at that time, the current state was sometimes they said no. Maybe they hadn't seen the evidence, or for whatever reason they said no. If they said, okay, we're going to give it, then the doctor had to write a prescription. Then the antibiotic had to be present in the hospital, either in labor delivery or the pharmacy. But it often wasn't, because the physicians were using a broad array of antibiotics, each one their personal favorite. And this hospital, with its very limited resources, could not stock all of those antibiotics. They just didn't have the resources to do it. And so if the answer was no, then the doctor had to write another prescription. The patient took the antibiotic prescription outside the hospital to buy from a local vendor, brought it back in, and had to somehow get it to delivery in time, which is, of course, very difficult. This is the new system. They plan to perform a cesarean delivery. The doctor actually used a standing order prescription. There was never a decision not to use an antibiotic. The only question was, is the patient allergic to a cephalosporin or not, and the only two antibiotics had to be stocked, a very cheap cefazolin or a macrolide antibiotic. The nurse puts the antibiotic in the packet. The packet goes on the stretcher with the patient to the OR, and it's given. So pretty simple system, and it takes out a lot of misery and suffering, and actually money was saved because the antibiotic that was standard was quite cheap. Next slide shows you a rather complicated graph, but I'll talk you through it. The little black diamonds show the reduction, statistically significant reduction over time, in the surgical site infection. The clear circles are the giving the antibiotics at all, and you can see that the provision of antibiotics increased dramatically over time to nearly 100%. The clear squares are giving them on time, and as you can see, that increased to nearly 100% as well. And so by using sophisticated time series analysis and multivariable models, it turns out that the correlation between the improved processes and the outcomes being reduced was very significant. So that's pretty complicated statistics, but the graphic is pretty compelling. Now, there were other things that happened as a result of this project, and I've listed them on the next slide. I'm not going to go into these, but when you get into improvement, you find a lot of stuff that can be improved very, very quickly. Now, the next slide makes the point that that analysis I showed you from Bogota was pretty complicated, time series analysis. But actually, it doesn't always have to be so complicated and sophisticated. As long as you display the data in what I call time-ordered way, multiple data observations over time, even if they're just a few observations, you would be surprised that 12 or 20 or so observations, even of relatively small numbers like 10, can give you meaningful results over time. So statistical process control, which I'll show you, is the standard quality improvement technique, and it's very robust and You pick the statistical process control method depending on your data, but simple run charts work well as well. And I'll give you these examples in just a second. Let me just say that you should practice this yourself. The most important thing Don Berwick taught me is to practice improvement and the charting of time-ordered data yourself. Whether you get the kids off to school on time, just put a tick every day, yes or no, or sum it up every week and say, you know, 4 out of 6 days, 5 out of 6 days, or whatever. I did one on getting the clinical infectious disease rounds on time. I just started a run chart on the blackboard of how many minutes late I was for rounds every day, and I was able to figure out an improvement in my rounding so that I was virtually always within 5 minutes of being on time. Don Berwick's was how many nights a week he had dinner with the family. These are really simple things you can do to get intuitive understanding of systems and how you improve them and how you can, without a lot of labor, collect and display time-ordered data. So here's a statistical process control chart on the next slide. This happens to be health care associated central line infections from a unit in Children's Hospital Philadelphia. Very elegant and clear and statistically significant. But the next slide shows something even simpler. This is just a run chart, and it's from a project in the Scottish Patient Safety Program on Clostridium difficile rates. Notice there are no fancy statistics here or p-values, but I can tell you there are run chart rules that anybody can learn. They can print them on one side of an index card that will tell you with great statistical probability that this readjustment of the rate to that new low level you see there was statistically significant. So run charts seem like they're really, really simple, but they are based on sound statistical observations, and you shouldn't be afraid to show them. So next slide. Now, measurement is really key for all quality improvement, and there are three types of measures. Structure. By structure, I mean design in the facility, the improvement capacity, your committees. Processes are the key processes and practices, and this is important, that are tightly linked to the outcome of interest. For example, adhering to a central line infection bundle, we know that those elements have been shown by evidence to be tightly associated with better rates of infection, lower rates of infection. So it's not just any processes. It's processes along the causal chain to the outcome of interest. And I see people often measuring what's convenient or intuitive, but it's not the right process because it's not linked by evidence to the outcome. And finally, outcomes. Now, if outcomes are relatively rare or it takes a long time to get enough data to really be sure you're improving, that's fine. But everybody wants to see the outcomes, and at least you should be displaying the data you have. Next slide. The aims that you set, there always should be a measurable goal in quality improvement. They should be strategic, important, and preferably a little bit stretched. Now, not too much stretch. You don't want to set aspirational goals that are impossible, but you want to challenge people to do better than they think they can do. The aims have to be actionable. No point having an aim like, let's improve the health of the children of the world, if that's not something that is actually within your span of control. And the aims, of course, have to be measurable. Next slide. The measures should be simple, digestible, graphic, and possible to collect as part of routine work. Now, that may not always be possible, but I'll tell you, I see complex measures all the time where simple ones would do. I see measures that are so complex and arcane that no one can understand them. I've seen them presented in a way that is not graphic. You can't really see from the back of the room what's going on. And I really do think that good measures, most of the time, can be collected as part of routine work if you look at this not as a research project but as an improvement project. Measuring for improvement is got to be convenient. You can't hire a nurse or a tech or find a medical student to record all the data for you, and in fact, you'll be less motivated if you outsource that. So collect it during routine work when you can. Next slide. This is the IHI staff. We're a small not-for-profit. We now have actually about 107, I think it is, employees, but a very large faculty that works with us from around the world. We try and stay intentionally small. I'm in the front row there, that big picture in the coat and tie. looking gray but smiling because it's a fun place to work. Next slide. So I can't tell you everything about IHI. That's an hour right there. But I can tell you that we go by the Institute of Medicine's six aims. And that these aims are, I think, applicable for anywhere in the world. Care should be safe without any needless deaths or harms. It should be effective. We should be following scientific knowledge, giving treatments or practices to all who could benefit, but not those who are not likely to benefit. That only wastes money and causes harm. Care should be patient and family-centered so people don't feel helpless and not involved in the decisions. It should be timely without unwarranted waiting, especially waiting that causes harmful delays. I'll tell you, somebody did a formal analysis of waiting for a woman who has a lump detected in her breast from that moment until the time she has definitive care. And in most institutions, 96% or 97% of all the time is of no value to the patient. And in some places now, you can have your lump detected, get your proper x-ray, have a second opinion, and go to your surgical procedure all within 24 hours. So that's what I mean by timely. Efficient means there's no waste. That can be equipment, supplies, importantly, ideas and energy. You know, a good idea that's wasted is a tragedy. Energy that's wasted ultimately results in loss of interest and failure. Energy is always high at the start of a project. It tends to wane over time, so keeping track of the energy and not wasting it's important. And it has to be equitable for all. I live in a country with shameful disparities in virtually every aspect of healthcare, the richest country on earth, and yet we have people who are blacks or Latinos or American Indians who have far worse outcomes than people who happen to be born with a different skin culture or ethnicity. So nothing I'm proud of, and we try and begin to tackle that. Now, IHI's well-known for 100,000 Lives campaign, the idea here was to, quote-unquote, save 100,000 lives, which would have deaths that would have occurred if these planks or practices were not in play. Now, I'm not going to defend the calculation of 100,000 lives and all that. That's beyond the scope of today. But it was a very highly visible effort, and we did try and find practices with a fair amount of evidence behind them where we thought harms could be avoided and lives could be saved, and I've listed them on this slide. You'll see that three of them are infection-related. When I came to IHI at the start of that campaign, I was kind of surprised and delighted to see my very own interest reflected in the campaign. Next slide, that went on to the 5 Million Lives campaign designed to prevent 5 million harms, and that was focused, again, the two of them on infections, surgical complications and infections and MRSA. So a lot of interest at IHI in infection control in these large national campaigns. I will tell you that 4,000 hospitals did sign up for the campaigns. That's the vast majority in the United States. And we still maintain a network of what we call nodes in, I think it's all but one state in the United States, so that we can continue to spread best practices as we learn about them. Now, what's needed to improve? You'll remember I said on the next slide, will, ideas, and execution. I hope you've caught up. I forgot to say next slide. So we're on what's needed to improve, will, ideas, and execution. So where do the ideas come from? How do we increase our degree of belief that the ideas are valid? And how do we spread what works? So it's great to have will, but if you don't have good ideas, you're not going to get very far. It's great to have will and great ideas if you don't know how to execute and get results on the ground. The will and the ideas are wasted. So the next slide shows another way of looking at this as kind of a production system, or we call it COGS. The first is to have a clear, measurable aim. Find out who is has the will, who wants to work with you. Find the best ideas that you can to solve the problem, to meet the aim. Test them, and then as you get some confidence in those ideas, go to more varied contexts and conditions, different kinds of hospitals or communities, demonstrate they'll still work there, and then deploy them at large scale and still demonstrate that they're working. So results at scale is the ultimate goal here, then you'll see that you're gradually building will along the way and feeding back learning into new aims and new practices. So it's a nice engine, if you will, for getting from somebody's will and good ideas to execution and results at scale. Do notice that not every practice needs to go through this. So right now, if I were working in Tanzania in an operating room, and somebody said, well, there is this checklist that Atul Gawande developed that seems to work in countries with limited resources, you wouldn't go back and set a new aim and find new ideas. You'd find a way to execute in that context in Tanzania to make sure that the checklist actually works there and can produce results. Next slide. So assessing will is really important. And again, we're talking about major changes. And you have to ask the question always in improvement, what are we trying to accomplish? Otherwise, it won't feel strategic and your will won't be very good. What investments are we willing to make? You know, whatever you decide to do, chances are something else isn't going to get done. There's always what economists call opportunity costs. So you have to think, well, if we do that, what are we going to not do? What are we going to de-emphasize? There's always going to be conflict. Are we willing to take it on? Are we going to be able to help people resolve their differences about the evidence and about the change in practice and culture? What risks are we willing to take? There's always risk. And in fact, sometimes the risks are to the patient. So I firmly believe that most quality improvement doesn't have to go through a human studies institutional review board, but that means you have to be aware of and measure unanticipated consequences. So, for example, let's say you're working in a hospital ward and your goal is to get 100% of patients with MRSA or whatever the infection is on isolation precautions. Well, that's great to achieve 100%, but not if it means that patients don't get visited, to have their blood pressure taken, or their other vital signs aren't monitored correctly. So always think, what could happen I'm not thinking about? And then finally, there's always disruption, and you have to be willing to manage it. Next slide. So there are four steps on the pathway from innovation to demonstration and spread, and I'm going to go through them. Next slide. First, research and development. We have a very, I think, low-waste process here at IHI, which I'd love to see replicated widely, because I think with some training and some commitment, this can be done virtually anywhere. We do our R&D work in 90 days. Sometimes we'll do a second cycle to make it 180 days, but the point here is there's a deliverable after a very short period of time. So we have some innovators and just a few research assistants that we support to do this so we can run five or six of these projects at a time. We've now run, I think it's getting up on 100 of these. We scan the environment always for new ideas in healthcare and from industry, because sometimes the best ideas come from other fields. We prioritize topics. Remember, we can't do everything, so we listen to our customers and look at our strategy and decide what to do. We then develop and pay careful attention to this, four things: a conceptual or a theoretical model for achieving a concrete goal. This is really important. What are we hypothesizing? What do we think the model is, the concepts that will actually get us to this goal we want to achieve? Secondly, now we need a logic model with key drivers. What are the main things we're going to do that have an evidence base that we think are tightly linked to those outcomes? If you remember my previous statements, and I will get to a driver diagram today, especially if I pick up my pace. What are the explicit hypotheses we're testing? And then what promising improvements or change concepts are we wanting to test? What have we found that seems to work in the world that we're going to use as changes to meet our goals and that will help us help our drivers get moving? So that's really important, and keep that in mind. At the end, we'll develop a technical brief and specifications for further work. We'll decide if we found something that has traction and we want to go on to further developing, or whether it was a bust. And frankly, if we didn't take enough risk so that at least 20% of our projects were complete failures, I'd be unhappy. And then if indicated, we'll develop a plan for further prototyping and testing, and that's on the next slide. I'm going to skip this slide. Just go on to the next one. Prototype testing is an early form of increasing our confidence in what we found in our research and development or what other ideas that are brought to us. Importantly, we specify aggressive goals and high-level measures. These are aims, the specific measurable aims, and we want it to be a little bit raise the bar so that people feel like this is meaningful change. We're not just making small incremental change. We intensively evaluate the validity and feasibility of all those things I mentioned, the conceptual model, the key drivers along the causal chain to the outcome, the change package itself, and the targets we're trying to achieve. And we determine if even one or two highly committed organizations, usually organizations with whom we work a lot, can achieve those targets. And we determine whether to proceed with pilot testing under further and different context, abandon the idea, or go back to R&D. So very important, we have to show that somebody, somewhere, can actually make this work. And it's a constant process to go back to our model and our drivers and our changes and say, what do we need to do to make this work? Next slide shows pilot testing. Here we expand the testing, often in a collaborative of organizations, maybe 20, 30, 40 organizations, where we're trying to increase our degree of belief that the changes in our model will result in improvement under a broader range of conditions and contexts. That's extremely important. Only then are we generally ready for spread and dissemination, such as we did in our campaign through our nodes and our mentor centers of excellence. Now, even at that stage, it's important to trust but verify. So we are a little bit in the habit of IHI of spreading ideas but not determining on the ground whether people are actually adopting the ideas so that we can demonstrate the spread worked. And I'll just throw that out as a caution. We tend to get carried away with our enthusiasm and our optimism, and we sometimes don't do this. And you know, people pick this up. I was speaking to a young Harvard College freshman today who's happens to be a Chinese woman, and she goes back to China to work in rural areas, and she was doing a project in the fall of her freshman year, and she said, you know, Professor Goldman, she said, I don't understand. I see this major regional and national program to reduce tuberculosis, it sounds good, but if I look at all the different contexts and cultures and situations in rural China, I don't understand where it's been tested to show that it actually works at the scale that's intended. Now, I happen to know that China has done a pretty good job with TB control, but her point was so profound. Here's a freshman in college with a kind of mind that says, don't spread it till you understand how and where and if it's going to work. Next slide. Now, execution sounds easy. It's actually the hardest thing to do, and I'm not going to give you a lecture on execution except to say that, first of all, your goals have to be clear. Industry tells us that most organizations, even GE or Honda, can only have a couple of breakthrough goals in a given year. So choose carefully. Make sure that the goals are not just aspirational pie in the sky. They're stretched. They feel hard to do, but they are realistic. We very often set aspirational goals at IHI, and we're trying to get better at saying, well, what's realistic and what's aspirational? Let's be clear. There should be a portfolio of projects that will logically support the breakthrough goals. And you may have 5 or 10 projects going on in the organization, all of them related to achieving that overarching major goal. Down on the left-hand corner, you see manage local improvement in projects. Well, that's something we don't do well. We often don't really pay attention to the execution, to the management of a project in a ward or in an emergency department or in a clinic. We get carried away with the big picture and don't really, as we say in the United States, tend to our knitting. On the right-hand corner, you see develop human resources. In my experience, middle management in most organizations, and certainly frontline staff, don't know how to run a project. And that's not an insult. It's just the facts. It's not part of training. So to expect people to manage projects, let alone improvement projects, with no training and support is foolish. Next slide. Models, drivers, and associated change packages must be tested and refined in the real world. And the key word there is tested. So on the next slide, you see the model for improvement that we use. this is so simple, it's kind of embarrassing to have to even say that it's some great concept, but people tend not to follow it. And the important thing here is you have to ask, what are we trying to accomplish? Again, what's the measurable goal, even in a small test of improvement? How will we know that a change is really an improvement? What are we going to measure? And what are the actual changes we're going to test? And these tests are not tests you perform over a six-month period. These are small tests. The next three patients coming into my clinic, I'm going to try a different way of screening them for tuberculosis. Or I'm going to, on the next week, we're going to test placing the alcohol dispensers at the foot of the bed. These are small tests for improvement, not massive design projects that'll take a year, and if you fail, everybody will throw up their hands in despair. This is iterative testing. I can't say that strongly enough. What this really is every time you do this, you're making a prediction. You're making a bet that if you do such and such a change, such and such a measure will actually improve, and that will get you towards meeting your aim. So this PDSA, or Plan, Do, Study, Act, Cycle, Plan, Do, Check, these are all different words for the same thing. It's basically saying, what did we predict and what actually happened and what do we need to refine, retool, revise for the next test? So I hope that's clear. Next slide. Well, how much evidence do we need before spreading a change, and how much confidence do we need in the change concept? So given the time, I'm going to be very quick on this slide. This is a way to think about it, and I guess I would like you to study it at your leisure, but I'll just orient you to it. So on the left-hand side, you see very simple linear cause and effect. So you give a blood pressure pill, the blood pressure drops. And for those kinds of situations, traditional randomized controlled trials really are the gold standard. Case studies and anecdotes aren't very good. That's what you see down there in the bottom in the left lower quadrant. That's poor learning. But our traditional RCTs work well. For complex, chaotic systems in which most of us work and where improvement is generally trying to be made, static, regular, randomized controlled trials really don't work very well. And I've listed some ideas there about adaptive cluster randomized trials and using anthropology, ethnography, qualitative sciences. These are useful. These quasi-experimental methods are very useful in these complex systems. And on the next slide, you can see some examples of these study designs. Now, I'm not going to go over this too much for today, but just by coincidence, just this past week, I published a commentary in JAMA, which I hope you all have pretty good access to, Journal of the American Medical Association, on comparative effectiveness research that in 1,200 words goes over the essence of this. So I hope you'll read it. Or not, it's up to you, but I think that it's worth at least a quick glance. The next slide shows some examples from real work to demonstrate that by marshaling the people you have at the front line, you can do pretty decent research, especially if you give them credit for what they're doing and assure them that if it's published or presented, they're going to be the people up front. So here was the first study I did with an infectious disease fellow. It was way back in the days when antibiotic prophylaxis were given often for as much as 6 days. That's the sort of turquoise bars on the bottom. And at that time, it was considered standard of care, good practice to give antibiotics for 48 hours. I know that seems foolish today, but that's what the evidence showed way back in 1980. And you can see that all we did was to adopt a standard antibiotic order form that made the clinician specify if they wanted the antibiotics to last for more than 48 hours for prophylaxis. The vast majority of clinicians said, that's fine, that's what we intended anyway, we just forget to stop the antibiotics. One doctor said, I do surgery on osteosarcoma, and he wasn't willing to go along with that. So we said, fine, you just do, that's a special case, fine. But you can see that in general, the average time for antibiotic prophylaxis fell precipitously with a standardized order set. So this is another slide done with the infection preventionists and the microbiologists at my hospital. I don't mean to say everybody has these resources available. It's just to show you that the people who work with you on an everyday basis can do great things if it's a clearly set up project. This looks complicated. But again, it's relatively simple. On the vertical axis, you see the rate per 1,000 patient days of respiratory syncytial virus infection in babies on an infant and toddler ward at my hospital. So that's just a rate of healthcare-associated RSV infection at my place. The horizontal axis is the exposure level. I call it the SNOT index. It's the percentage of beds on the ward occupied by a baby with respiratory syncytial virus. Now, remember, this is an annual disease, and there's always a community outbreak, and so the beds get filled very rapidly with kids with coughing and wheezing and snot. So two axes, exposure level and the incidence of infection. We surreptitiously, we secretly monitored compliance with gown and glove precautions on this ward, and we found that the compliance was 37%. Pretty pathetic. And when the compliance was at that level, you see the steep, solid line going from the bottom left up to the top right. That is the relationship between the SNOT index, the beds occupied by RSV, and the incidence of infection. And as you'd expect, there's a very strong correlation given the lousy infection prevention practice. The other line, the one with the gentler slope, is what happened after we instituted open surveillance. The minute we told people we were surveying, the rate of compliance went up over 90%. And interestingly, the effect was so dramatic and visible that when we took away the open monitoring and did it secretly again, it stayed at almost 90%. So people actually saw the effect and bought in. You can see there's still a relationship. Nothing's perfect. But look at the difference in the slope of that line. The difference in the highest epidemic period with 35% of the beds with kids from the community with snot dripping out of their nose was four times less than it was in the low compliance era. And let me tell you, I'm particularly happy about the study because there are almost no studies, just a couple of studies in the literature that demonstrate that gown and glove precautions actually work in a ward setting. And it was done by folks who basically volunteered their time to collect the data as part of their routine rounding and their work. Next slide. So we did a hand hygiene study, right? And this is very complex. It was done with Stefan Harbarth, and we get funding from industry. And we were going to show putting alcohol-based hand gel on the intensive care units, our medical, our surgical, and our neonatal intensive care units, was going to revolutionized compliance with hand hygiene. And we had four periods here. And I'm just going to flash the results on the next slide. I don't need to go over this with you in any depth because, number one, you can see the effect, if any, was very modest. And number two, you can see the compliance never got up over 40%. That's pretty pathetic. That is a negative study. Does that mean that gel doesn't work, that making it available is a bad idea? Or does it mean we didn't set up a good quality improvement study? So we asked the staff, what happened here? We put this gel out. Everybody says, Didier Pate, Stefan Harbarth, WHO, this is a great thing to do, and you guys didn't use it. What happened? And of course, they had a lot of feelings about this. And many of them said, we're not satisfied with the gel. In fact, only 45% liked it. It was what we had from the manufacturer. I didn't like it. It was kind of tacky, actually. It didn't smell so good to me. Some of them didn't think that the gel helped with compliance, but that was in part because of the sticky, uncomfortable feeling. They didn't think it was located properly. The posters were interesting. Stefan brought over from Geneva these posters. Well, I didn't actually think they were very funny or effective, but these were the posters they used in Geneva. Geneva is the best place. But we didn't think of the local context. Our staff hated these posters. They thought they were crass and they weren't funny and that they were from Switzerland. So developing some local materials is important. We had an opinion leader, the most prominent, influential guy we could find on that those units. Trouble is, we didn't give him the tools and the training he needed to be effective, and only a few people even knew there was an opinion leader. And finally, they didn't think the feedback was timely, so they didn't change their behavior. And there was a lot of other stuff. We actually published this negative study because we were so struck about all the lessons it had about trying to do quality improvement when you just institute an undeniably effective intervention but without thinking of everything else that has to be done. All right, now we're going to talk about reliability in bundles and get to some practical examples related to today's infection control problems. Next slide, we're going to talk about MRSA, and then the next. This is a slide that was in Lancet. It's now somewhat old, but it makes a very important point. It's MRSA in Europe. And on this slide, you can see all the countries, not all, but a number of countries listed. And all you have to do is look at the slide from afar, and you'll see there's a lot of variation. So the little vertical hatch lines are the median rate of MRSA in these various countries. And you can see it varies from about 50% of the isolates being MRSA, staph isolates, down to none, virtually, in the Netherlands and Denmark. But look within an individual country. In many of these countries, all those little circles are hospitals. And so let's say you're looking at Germany. Well, the median rate is respectable compared to some of the other countries, but some of the hospitals are up there 50%, and some of them are now near zero. Look at all that variation. What does this have to teach us? Quality improvement always starts with looking at variation, a very powerful tool. Next slide. So is it due to the virulence of the distinct genotypes of MRSA? Well, no, we know that's not the case. Is it the size and the design and type of the hospitals? Well, yeah, I think that's important, but there's no way that you can look at Belgium and the Netherlands, where hospitals of similar age are only, 50 miles apart, and caring for similar types of population, and the results are vastly different. So I think design's important, but it can't explain all of this. It certainly isn't due to case mix. That's been shown over and over again. But it's probably due to practice variation by and large. Both compliance with known, measurable, evidence-based practices and less tangible features like the culture and organization of an intensive care unit. So I've been involved in a neonatal ICU collaborative where site visits were made, and it turned out that some of the best performers simply regarded every infection as intolerable and potentially preventable. That was their culture. In others with high rates, they said, oh, these tiny babies are 800 grams, they're all going to get infections, so what can we do? So these intangibles, you remember that slide I showed you at the beginning with the variation in the six intensive care units. That's the unmeasured stuff that has to be addressed through quality improvement. Next. So here's a modest proposal. Why don't we try and improve the reliability of basic infection control procedures like the ones on this slide? Next slide. So, reliability science, and it is a science, there are national meetings on reliability, argues that healthcare is riddled with defects. 40 or 50% compliance with hand hygiene. You know what happens at Intel? Well, I shouldn't be saying this. Intel today announced a $1 billion loss due to a chip error. So this it's like Toyota. The example is looking less good today. But I can tell you that in Intel, if you walk into a clean room and don't gown, glove, grease, do all the stuff they want you to do, the first time you get a warning, the second time you're up, you're likely to be fired because they have a multi-million-dollar bet lying on chip trays in those clean rooms. So that's important. And Bowling Green, which was the first hospital I saw do this, they actually made it an accountability issue. They said, okay, the first time we find you not practicing hand hygiene, we're going to just remind you. The second time, we're going to ask you to please take a repeat of the little educational program on hand hygiene. The third time, we're going to tell your department chair, and in fact, we may bring you through the committee that credentials you, that allows you to practice. So a scaling up, and to my knowledge, they never had to go to the credentials committee because accountability was very clear. Remember, in reliability, from the patient's point of view, it's all or nothing. They don't want one out of five required processes done right. They went all five. Let's look at an example of that in the next slide. This is data that I kind of put together. It's not the real data, but it's changed because the paper is under consideration for publication. I had to change it. But basically, this is what it says. It says that if you look at individual practices for complete adherence to contact precautions, yeah, the hand hygiene might be done and the gloves put on 80% of the time, the gown 78% of the time, 65% of the time there'll be hand hygiene at the end, but only 50% of the time did all three of those things get done. So that's not very good practice from the point of view of the patient. So reliability is failure-free operation over time from the viewpoint of the patient. Next slide. Here's an example from heart failure. So let's say a patient is has heart failure. The outpatient care isn't doing things like monitoring the compliance with medications, asking about swelling of the ankles, and so forth. A patient ends up in the hospital. Then there are a variety of evidence-based practices for heart failure patients that should be done all the time. They're on the IHI website. They're in the American College of Cardiology website. But if they're not done that well, then the outcome of the patient isn't as good as it could be. And then when the patient's discharged, if they're not discharged with a good follow-up plan and the same defects occurred that got them there in the first place, that they'll be back in the hospital. So, from the point of view of the patient, it's the whole trajectory of care, not one episode or one component. So the next slide shows you levels of reliability. And what we'd like to do is have reliability 99.99% of the time or higher, as we do in certain critical industries like nuclear power now, following Three Mile Island and other international disasters, very highly reliable. Airlines are very highly reliable, at least when it comes to flying. But in medicine, only blood banking and anesthesiology are highly reliable. The rest of us are mired in what reliability scientists call chaos. That means failure in greater than 20% of the opportunities using the composite all-or-nothing measure. So that's not very good to hear, but that's the norm. 20% or less is the norm. Now, one way to tell whether or not you're likely to find reliable practices is to go up on a ward and just ask five different people to articulate specifically the practices that are supposed to be followed for whatever it is, central line care or whatever. If you find that five people can't reliably and accurately articulate the standard practice, then you'll never have good reliability. And you'd be amazed. Go try it sometime. We've done a lot of the so-called shop floor, where you go on the floor and you ask people, what are you really doing? And we find that they just can't describe it. Next slide. So reliability, remember, it's all or nothing. Most institutions do okay on individual stuff, but not on the whole package. And we're trying to get to reliability, I would say, at least to 95%. Now, next slide differentiates guidelines from bundles. Guidelines tend to be very long, all-inclusive, and somewhat confusing. Many of the potential interventions are supported by some but not great evidence. For example, I love the CDC guidelines. I was on the HCPAC, the CDC Guideline Committee, so I think we wrote great guidelines. But frankly, they're long. A lot of the key issues are left unaddressed. There's a welter of things you're supposed to do. And then they're difficult to translate into action, and they're often ignored by clinicians. I was involved in a conference on antibiotic resistance just a year and a half or so after the Infectious Disease Society of America published what I thought were excellent guidelines on what hospitals should do to improve antibiotic prescribing. And almost all of the experts in the room couldn't tell me where they had stored the guideline, and very few of them had read it since it came out. So hard to use these big, bulky guidelines. So what if just a few key actionable interventions supported by strong evidence were culled from the guidelines and put into practice? Next slide. So a bundle, which is what we're talking about here, is a grouping of best practices with respect to a disease process that individually improve care, but when applied together result in substantially greater improvement. At least that's the theory. The science is so well established it should be considered standard of care, although I have to say we cheat on that all the time. And bundle elements are dichotomous. In other words, you can measure, was it done, yes or no. And it's not a piecemeal thing. It's all or nothing, which we've covered before. So pretty simple. The term bundle, as I said, is often used and abused, but nonetheless, I think it's a useful concept. Now, the next slide will show you five key interventions that we put on our website, many of you, I'm sure, use for reducing MRSA. First of all, since most of the infections come from central venous lines and ventilators, getting the care of those right through those bundles is really important. Hand hygiene is important. Active surveillance testing, it's not just culture now. Many people think are important, and I know it's a little controversial. decontamination of the environment since staff does survive in the environment, and then contact precautions. These are five key interventions that most of you probably have some faith in. Next slide. Skip that one. Let's go to this slide that says, what changes can we make? So this is a driver diagram, and I hope you can see that pretty clearly. And you'll see on the left-hand side the aim of the improved system. Then there are the primary drivers, those drivers, those ideas that are most important in getting to the outcome. Secondary drivers enable the primary drivers to work. And then there are a bunch of changes that enable each of the secondary drivers. So we're going from cause on the right to effect on the left. It's a causal chain of drivers. Next slide. So let's say the aim is a new me. There I am. I know you can't see me, but, you know, I'd be lying if I said that I didn't look exactly like that. I wish. But that's the goal. So how many drivers are there? Well, I only know of two drivers, calories in and calories out. If you have other drivers to get to the ideal weight, let me know. Behind those drivers, you can imagine some secondary drivers. For calories in, it's limiting daily intake, substituting low-calorie foods, avoiding alcohol. Now, I like to drink a glass or two of wine a night, and that's calories in, but it also affects calories out because after my one or two glasses of alcohol, I am quite unlikely to go to the gym or to take a walk on a dark street. So drivers can affect more than one primary driver. Calories out, I can work out, I can walk to errands. The fellow who gave me this slide now has what he calls fidgeting. It turns out if you fidget and just that kind of person, that wastes calories, so it can drive calories out as well. And then what are the changes? Well, you could track your calories, you could plan your meals, you could drink water and not soda. I never drink any Coca-Cola that's got sugar in it or whatever. These are all important changes, and you can see that these will have associated with them measures, outcome and structure and process measures, and here are some of them. So it's important if my aim is going to be a real aim, what is the measure? Weight, BMI, body fat, what is it? I got to count my calories in and out. And then if I'm going to limit my daily intake, I've got to count my calories that are coming in. I've got to say how many bottles of wine have I drunk this week, whatever it is. And then if I'm saying I'm not going to drink Coke with sugar, how many of those did I actually have a week? So you can see, you can begin to develop personal run charts based on easily collected data as part of routine life. Next slide. So now we're talking about reducing MRSA. Forget the VRE and C diff for a minute. We'll just focus on MRSA. And the primary drivers here are two, preventing transmission and preventing infection. So preventing transmission is the spread of the organism in your organization or in the community. Preventing infection is preventing the invasion through a line or a ventilator. And now you see all those five change ideas that I had up there on the previous slide are now secondary drivers. Identifying patients with active surveillance testing, contact precautions, room cleaning and disinfection, dedicated equipment, reliable hand hygiene, they're all there. And again, some of them, like hand hygiene, both prevent infection and prevent transmission. Now, there's a vertical, a horizontal line at the bottom, and below it, it says, use decolonization to decrease burden of organisms. We always have a below-the-line driver and changes because evidence tends to emerge over time. When I made this slide, chlorhexidine washcloths were just being tested. Now we have real evidence they work, and maybe you'd put them up above the line as part of your main drivers and changes. And then here are some measures that go along with the changes on the next slide, and I'm not going to go through those in the interest of time, but if you have a driver and you have a change, you got to measure in some way whether it's being reliably practiced and implemented. Next slide. And you can get some pretty good results if you set some aims and go about it methodically. This is the fall of MRSA bloodstream infection in England. A target that was set nationally, and everybody laughed at it, but in fact was more than achieved. This is their work on C. diff. Again, some excellent results, and I think in the U.S. we're starting to see some pretty good progress as well, at least in some regions. So these things aren't hopeless if there's a discipline approach. Next slide. So here's some other bundles. This is a central venous catheter bundle, which I hope you're all aware of. I'm not going to go into it in detail. Notice that down the bottom, though, in parenthesis or below the line, are alcohol, hub prep, and other measures, because all of this bundle is about insertion, right? And we know that some infections occur during the maintenance of the catheter. We know that the hub, if not properly maintained, is a source of infection. So it's kind of not smart to only deal with insertion. And my theory is that many organizations, when they start getting reliable about insertion and they develop checklists and monitoring and feedback, notice the other things that they know should be done and start getting reliable at those as well. Next slide. This just shows you data from two slides, one a CDC study in Pennsylvania, and then down the bottom, the striking data from Peter Pronovost, published in the New England Journal, showing a remarkable decline in 103 ICUs in Michigan using this bundle, accompanied by some really important changes in safety culture and communication. Not often talked about, but I think Peter and his team would say that that may have been as important as the bundle, improving teamwork and communication. And this reduction has been sustained in subsequent publications, and I believe that this group has a paper in BMJ appearing this week that will further expand on this. So, and I could show you a bunch of other examples, but that's what I'm going to stop at today. And here's a ventilator bundle. You're all familiar with that. Now, you'll remember, I hope, that the IHI bundle for ventilators was not a pneumonia bundle. It included peptic ulcer disease prophylaxis, which, if anything, increases the risk of ICU pneumonia, and deep vein thrombosis prophylaxis, which has nothing to do with pneumonia. And chlorhexidine mouth care, which I think is very evidence-based, wasn't in the bundle to begin with, although it's now a part of the teaching. So what is that? That's really paradoxical. Two of the changes have nothing to do with pneumonia, may actually increase the risk. There's a study that shows how hard it is to get 30 to 45 degree elevation ahead of the bed. Randomized control trial, I think, in Germany showed how hard that was. And we weren't even espousing chlorhexidine mouth care, and yet ICU after ICU has now gone months without a ventilator pneumonia. So there's obviously something more at play here than just these specific changes. Again, all those unmeasured variables and other things that people pay attention to when they get serious about improvement. I'm going to skip the surgical site infection slide out of time and go to the hand hygiene bundle. So here you have the various components that I think are very important in hand hygiene from my own point of view, and this is what you'll find on our website. First, staff knowledge, but of course, teaching, education is the least effective of all behavioral science modalities. My talk today, however animated I am, and however excited and enthusiastic I am, and however receptive you are, will probably have no effect 6 months from now. Education alone just doesn't work. It's the truth. That's what the studies show. But I hope you learn something, and maybe it'll work for you. But that's the overall assessment. Staff competency, really important. If they know what to do but can't demonstrate they can do it, doesn't count. So when we were orienting our new junior doctors, we wouldn't give them lunch till they demonstrated how they could use alcohol hand rub, because competence is really important. Getting the right stuff available at the point of care is incredibly important. If a hospital hasn't provided alcohol and gloves at the point of care in a way that the staff finds convenient, then it's a lost cause. And this includes dispensers that are operational, full, and dispense the correct volume of rub. You know, squirting alcohol on your shoes because the dispenser is not functioning correctly, or finding two dispensers with nothing in them, will undo all the education and motivation immediately. Actually, three sizes of gloves would be better, too. I tend to break through the small size. And then correct performance of hand hygiene during real care, not just being competent, but actually monitoring care. And I like to focus on leaving the bedside. I know the other moments are really, really important, but for transmission, my bottom line is if you didn't practice it when you left the bedside, that's probably as bad as anything you could possibly do, and there ought to be a lot of accountability around that. But the 5 moments are all important. And finally, I've talked about accountability and the fact that people do respond to accountability, provided everything above that word accountability has already been done reliably. Can't hold people accountable if the dispensers don't work, if they don't know what to do, if they're not getting any data about performance. Just that doesn't work. And that's my presentation.
Thank you, Professor Goldman. Thank you so much for this very enlightening and enthusiastic talk, despite your cold, and I hope it doesn't make it any worse.
One thing we can do, if I may offer, if you can have people send you questions and you can synthesize them into some key issues that you want me to respond to, I can certainly do that.
That is wonderful. Thank you for suggesting that, Paul. Is that a possibility? Could we do that?
Questions can be sent to paul@webertraining.com, and I can forward them on.
Wonderful. Then thank you, Professor Goldman, and thank you to the audience for being there patiently. If you scroll down to the next slide, I think that has the calendar moving ahead. And the next one, as you can see, is on hand hygiene, education and monitoring, which is on April 6th. So tune in for that seminar. And I also want to take this opportunity to talk about an event that is coming soon. If you scroll to the last slide, that is 5th May 2011. That's the hand hygiene program that WHO launched about 2 years ago. As you can see, this is its third anniversary, and there are two objectives. This time, if you or your organization want a self-assessment to be done about where you are on a continuum of hand hygiene, then do go to the WHO website to answer a couple of questions, and you'll be able to figure out where your hospital or healthcare facility is on a continuum. The second, if your facility has not endorsed the WHO campaign on hand hygiene to prevent infection control, please take a moment and do visit the website and endorse by registering your facility. So with that, I would like to thank everybody, and I wish you good luck and a great day ahead.